And one of the symptoms of a person who's indifferent towards you is that he forgets your name during conversation. So sometimes we see, oh yeah, I remember you, I'm so happy to see you, what's your name? So one may say, oh, I'm so happy to see you, I remember everything about you and so many things. If he can't remember your name, it's, according to Hita Pradesh, it's a symptom that he's actually indifferent in his heart. So therefore, if I don't learn your names, then it's a symptom that I'm indifferent towards you. And if the teacher is indifferent towards the student, then how can the student learn? He can learn, but he cannot learn as well as if the teacher actually has an interest in him. So this is one of the practical things that Hita Pradesh teaches. One of the many practical things. So, let's see, back to Jacob. So today we'll begin then the first part, which is what's called prologue in your notebooks. You didn't get one, huh? You have one, David? No? You have. You also got. So you please look on with him, with David. So the tradition, as explained in the introduction, that traditionally any Vedic literature always begins with a Mangalacharanam, which is what we call invocation, or it actually means auspicious, invoking auspiciousness. So this first verse is the Mangalacharanam, text number one. May the saints, good students, achieve their goal by the grace of Lord Shiva, who has a crescent moon on his head, which appears like a streak of foam on the Ganges. So all of you who have seen any kind of drawing of Lord Shiva, you'll see he has a crescent moon. The name of Lord Shiva, which indicates that he has a crescent moon on his head, is Chandrasekharan. So they're beginning, this whole scripture begins by offering respect to Lord Shiva. So, now the reason that we have, or all these Vedic literatures have a Mangalacharanam, is to invoke auspiciousness and to invoke the Lord's blessings so that the work that is begun will become accomplished. It will be achieved. One will be able to accomplish the work. Because in every endeavor there's always so many obstacles. You're not Gayatri, Devi? What is your good name?
Ekanta
Devi. You were here yesterday, but your name was not on the list. So, here, the Mangalacharanam appears to teach us the etiquette before, just like we say, anytime anyone gives a class, he always offers a prayer to his spiritual master, or there's so many prayers that devotees recite before they begin even speaking or reading on spiritual topics. So this is considered, a Mangalacharanam. So here, in this verse, the author invokes the blessings of Lord Shiva, who is, of course, the greatest of all Vaishnavas. And if you want to actually get the blessings of Krishna, the Supreme Lord, then, of course, one has to get the blessings of the Supreme Lord of Krishna through Krishna's devotees, through Vaishnava. So Lord Shiva is known to be the greatest Vaishnava. So one gets the Lord's mercy through the Vaishnavas, and thus the author prays to Lord Shiva. It is also customary for a person desiring education to pray to Lord Shiva. This is recommended by Shukadeva Goswami in Bhagavatam 2, 3, and 7. 2, 2nd canto, 3rd chapter, 7th verse. Therein it's explained. There's verses 2 through 7, which explain if you want good health, you should worship Surya. If you want a good wife, you should worship Uma. If you want this, if you want that, whatever you want, there's different deities that you can worship in order to get them. And therein it's explained, if you want education, if you want to become educated, then you can offer respects to Lord Shiva, worship Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva is described here in this verse as having the Ganges water on his head, which signifies that he has received... What does it signify? Let's think. The Ganges water on your head, what does it signify?
Receive Lord Vishnu.
Exactly. Exactly. Why? Because the water, we know from 8th canto Srimad Bhagavatam, when Lord Vamana took his second step, his toe pierced the layers, the coverings of the universe, and the universe is floating on the Karana ocean, which emanated from Mahavishnu, and Mahavishnu is lying down in, so that water is touching the lotus feet of Mahavishnu, and that water entered through the crack of the universe and descended through all the different planets, and that is known as the Ganges. So when he has water, and of course when the Ganges, we know from the 8th canto Srimad Bhagavatam, that when the Ganges descent on this planet, she would not agree to land here unless they made some arrangement for her to, some place for her to descend. Because she thought, well, I'll come down with such great force that I'll wash away anything that I land on. And so she refused to come until Lord Shiva volunteered. He said, well, you can land on my head. Of course, his head is spiritual, indestructible. So then she agreed, because she had a place to land on Lord Shiva's head. Which means, as Jamasmi Guru said, that he has received the blessings of Lord Vishnu. One who puts Ganges on his water on his head. So, just as the Ganges descends from Lord Vishnu, so all knowledge flows from him. Just as the Ganges comes in a continuous flow, so knowledge also descends through the chain of disciplic succession. I'm not reading from your book. I'm reading from some commentary that's being prepared on these verses that you have. Now, in order to actually assimilate knowledge, there are some prerequisites. In order to assimilate knowledge, then one has to have a cool head. And the moon and the Ganges on the head means that means your head is cool. It doesn't mean you put ice on your head. Cool head means that you're not angry, that your mind is not disturbed by lust, anger, and greed. Right? That's what cool head means. And of course, cool head means sattva guna. Right? In order to actually learn, and actually in order to assimilate knowledge, then one has to be in the mode of goodness. And so the moon and the Ganges signify that one has to have a cool head. Also, receiving the Ganges on the head also signifies humility and respect. That one, whatever you touch to your head, it indicates that you're offering respect to that object. And of course, this should be the mood of the student. In order to learn, even if you have the best teacher. In other words, there's two things. In order to learn, you have to have a bona fide teacher. In order to learn, one has to be a bona fide student. If the teacher is bona fide and the student is not, then the knowledge will not be successfully transmitted. If the student is bona fide and the teacher is not, the same thing. The knowledge will not transmit successfully. Something may get across, but not the full understanding. So, Lord, this verse is explaining then also the qualities of the student is that he should be respectful and humble. A proud student cannot go very far. So Lord Shiva in this verse is referred to as Durjati. That's the name in the Sanskrit verse that has been translated here as Lord Shiva. Durjati means the one who has matted hair. If you've seen Lord Shiva, actually he has a big coil of matted locks on his head. And it said that even when the Ganges first descended and landed on his head, he held the whole river within his coils of his hair. That it landed on his head, and a whole river coming down landed on his head, with not one drop spilled out of his hair. He was holding it all in his hair. So this Durjati, or the matted locks, indicate tapasya, austerity. So this is another quality the student must have in order to learn. He must be austere. So it doesn't mean that we have to mat our hair, although Narada Muni does recommend that the brahmacharis should mat their hair. And Srila Prabhupada also, when he began this gurukul, he said, yeah, the boys should mat their hair and they should carry a brahmachari danda. But then the boys were so untrained that they started using the danda in ways that we didn't expect by beating each other. And so that program was canceled.
You had the brahmachari danda?
Yeah. But they were not well-behaved boys, the first group we had. So anyway, this signifies austerity. So austerity, humility, and respect, these are the qualities the student must have, which are described in this verse. Or this is, all this is within the verse. The moon on Lord Shiva's head appears like the foam on the Ganges, which falls from the celestial region. And this indicates that the knowledge is illuminating, it is brilliant. The story of the Ganges' descent is described in the 9th canto. I think I earlier said 8th canto, but it's 9th canto. Satam is used in this verse, and that refers, the Satam means we've translated, or it's been translated as the saints or good students or the virtuous persons. So he's the point is that the author is praying for the benefit of the good students. He's not praying for the benefit of unruly students or students who lack humility or lack respect. As we discussed yesterday, of course, if one lacks humility or lacks respect or lacks austerity, we know from Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, what is that verse, Prabhu, do you know, Damodar Prabhu? In the 18th chapter says, one who is envious of me or one who is not austere, then he cannot understand this message of Bhagavad Gita. So therefore, if one lacks these basic qualities of the student, then he cannot, that means he has bad character. And as we discussed yesterday, bad character and education go ill together. So the author then is praying for, he's giving his blessings to the well-behaved students. And to those who are not well behaved, he's neglecting, or he's not offering his blessings for them. So then we'll go on to text 2. So that is the Mangalacharanam, and so much information is contained therein about the student and the proper mentality. One has to be free from anger. One has to have a cool head, and that the knowledge must be received through Vaishnava, Lord Shiva, and so forth. So text number 2. After studying Hitopadesh, the student will be expert in using Sanskrit idioms. His speech in all fields will be wonderful, and he will learn polity, niti, the conduct of human affairs. So I want to read another definition of niti, because polity doesn't actually explain the term properly or fully. And as we go through again the rest of the text, I just want to use the word niti. And so I read a definition yesterday. I'll read another one today so that we get familiar with this term, so that we start to understand the full meaning when we use the word. So here it says, niti is a word like some others in Sanskrit, like dharma, for example. Some years ago there was an article in BTG about dharma, and there was a discussion how dharma we translate as religion or prescribed duties, but even those terms don't fully explain the full meaning of dharma. So niti is another such term. It is impossible to render into English by the use of a single word. It comprises meanings that convey several closely linked ideas. In fact, it signifies an attitude and conduct that expresses and represents a whole way of life. The concept of niti would include carrying out one's prescribed duties, familial and socio-political, and the exercise of practical wisdom in affairs private and public. Niti would entail resolute action taken after careful scrutiny and due deliberation. So it means niti, then he's explaining that niti means before acting, one has to deliberate and scrutinize very carefully What does he want to accomplish? And what is a proper way to accomplish that goal? In other words, it means thought. In order to accomplish any action, if you want to be victorious, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I am, for those who want victory, I am Niti. Because through use of Niti, then one achieves his desired goal. So it means then one has to be very thoughtful in order to achieve his goal. So it says, Niti would entail resolute action. Who knows, in Bhagavad Gita, there's resolute determination. Who knows? Vyavasayatmika buddhi, right? In the fourth, what is it? Fourth chapter, Damodar? Second chapter? 41st verse. Vyavasayatmika buddhi. Ekaho kurunanda. Okay, so Niti would entail resolute action taken after careful scrutiny and due deliberation. So impetuous activity, doing something without thinking, that is not included in Niti. That is something that is done without Niti. A discriminating judgment has to be brought to bear on all issues, problems, and situations. So one has to study everything with discriminating judgment. Stark distinctions of black and white, right and wrong, good and evil, can seldom be made in the sphere of human actions, though they are being made all the time. An all-around and harmonious development of human powers is the basis of Niti. Obsessions have no part in it. Obsessions are not based in reason. Obsession is just like, I want something, I don't know why, it's just some urge is motivating me to get something, but there's no thought, there's no deliberation behind it. So obsessions and frivolous activity, they are not included. To live wisely and well in the truest sense of these two terms, that is Niti. So we try to keep this idea in our mind when we hear this word, then Niti. It's a whole system of, it's an attitude, a very careful and thoughtful attitude by which one lives. And he employs in trying to achieve his goals. And of course, people of different character will have different goals in their mind. And so for us, who are devotees, and how we're trying to achieve the highest goal, then it will be the deliberate and careful way that we apply ourselves to please spiritual master and Krishna. So now here, the author explains the purpose. In the first verse, he's invoking auspiciousness. He's telling what are the qualities of the student what attitude he has to have in order to learn. And now he's explaining what the subject matter is. He stresses the what his purpose is in writing the book. It is written for the benefit of those who want to learn Sanskrit and simultaneously become expert in human dealings. Traditionally, this book is taught to the beginning students in Gurukula. Now, we should not think then that because it's taught to the beginning children, five, 6 years old, that it's kid stuff. It does appeal to children. It appeals to, the wonderful thing about this book is that it appeals to five-year-old children because they understand it on one level, that some animals are doing this and doing that, and they tricked each other. Even in the Hindi books they use in the school, the public schools here, they have stories about the crow and the jackal, the crow and the fox, I think. The crow is up in the tree, and he had a piece of stale chapati. You've seen that? He had a piece of stale chapati he's eating, and the dog, I think it was the fox. The fox comes, and he says, oh, my dear crow, so many days have passed, and I haven't heard you sing. You have such a beautiful voice. You know how the crows sound? They sound horrible. So we're sounding bird in Vrindavan. They have a horrible sound. But he says, oh, you please sing a song. I haven't got to hear your sweet voice in so many days. And so the crow says, oh, you want to hear him? He goes, quack. And when he goes to croak, or when he goes to squawk, the chapati falls out of his mouth and the fox catches it and runs off eating it. So the children think, oh, he tricked him, it's so funny. So the children are attracted. But yet an adult who hears this story, he can understand a deeper meaning. He can understand that flattery can be used to accomplish a goal, you know, some kind of duplicitous duplicitous flattery is used to accomplish your goal without saying what your goal is, right? The goal was for the guy to fill his belly, but he didn't go and say, hey, give me some food. He flattered him because he knew that flattery would lead to the result he wanted. So a child will understand it in one way, a very simple way, but an 80-year-old man will understand something very deeply about human nature, and he'll come away understanding something else. And so this is, and not only that, but this information, because it's about human nature, it appeals to anyone, young or old, in any social position. Here in India, you'll see the rickshaw wallahs know a lot of niti, or the merchants, or the cobblers in the street. They know how to achieve their goal very, very successfully. So it appeals to a man who has no social position, and it also appeals to kings. It's sometimes called rajniti. Kings would invite very learned brahmanas to come into their court and teach the princes and the royal children. So it's something that transcends any social status. It's something that transcends any language. This book has been translated in over 50 languages. And it's something that transcends even what, no matter what religious background you have. Actually, the first people who outside India, the first people who popularized this book were the Muslims. So it has a very wide appeal, and therefore it's considered a very classic literature, because it appeals to anyone who has a human body, practically. So because it teaches one how to actually get the most out of this human form of life, or use the human form very wisely. So it was taught to the beginning students in Gurukul. Now they would understand it in a very simple way. It's something like nowadays we have nursery rhymes. At least in the Western world we have nursery rhymes. And we teach those to our children just to entertain their minds, or just to... They actually have no... Practically they have no moral instruction. But in the traditional Vedic system, they would teach these stories to the children. And in Sanskrit verses, which would illustrate the different rules of grammar very simply, and at the same time it would teach them these clever stories about the exchanges of animals, which attracted them at 5 years old. But as they grow up and their intelligence develops, then they start to understand how these cute stories apply in human affairs, and how they can be used to achieve whatever goals you have. So this is the purpose of this book. Now these verses, of course, increase in utility as the student progresses in learning language and in being educated. So language is the tool which human beings use for communication, and childhood is the best time to acquire language. In Vedic education, much stress is laid on language. Okay, I'll skip over this part. This is one of the indispensable characteristics of a great man is good speech. It is said, the bird is known by his note, and the man is known by his words. The quality of a man, we can see, even here, especially when we hear in India, Hindi is spoken in so many different ways. The common man in the street, the rickshaw wallahs or something, will speak a certain Hindi, but it's very base. And yet an educated, saintly person, he'll speak Hindi in a completely different way, practically. Hey, did you bring me one of those books or not?
Did you?
I asked you for one. Whatever, maybe, yeah. Maybe you can help me get one if you didn't.
Oh, there's plenty around.
Okay,
sure.
Okay,
sure,
good.
I just figured you'd already got it.
No, I didn't. I've been looking and looking. Anyway.
You can use this for the time being.
All right. Or I'll get one from you.
You haven't seen it, have
you? No. This is Satsarup Maharaj's book on Niti Shastras. Sayings of Chanakya and Hitopadesh, as quoted by Srila Prabhupada, and how Srila Prabhupada used them. This must be very interesting. I want to also read this during the time we're having the course and try and bring more of this in. So, good speech. And of course, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that one of the types of austerities is austerity of speech, which means always reciting the Vedas regularly, avoiding speech that offends, always speaking in a way that is beneficial. So if one practices this, then he's actually performing austerity, always speaking truthfully. This is a very great austerity, Kali Yuga. So always, whatever you speak, speak the truth, or don't speak. So, therefore, man is known by the words he speaks. Now, after invoking the blessings of Lord Shiva in the first verse, explaining the purpose and importance of the book in the second verse, and also indicating the qualification of the reader, the author next glorifies education in five verses. So from text 3 through 8, or 7, then these next verses glorify education. So text then number 3. We've done a little work on it. This is an intelligent person. Excuse me, I'm going to read a different translation. It's similar to the one you have, but it's a little more clear. Considering oneself free from old age and death, an intelligent person should acquire education and earn wealth. But thinking that death has caught hold of one's hair, one's sika, one should engage in religious acts. Now this is discussing about how the attitude one should have. When one performs activities which lead to acquiring knowledge or wealth, then he should consider that he's free from old age and death, especially education. Sometimes we see in devotees, we think, well, you know, I joined the movement when I was 25 or 35 or older, 45. Therefore, for me now to memorize verses, forget it. Next life for me. Sometimes we have that attitude. Anyway, my next life, I'll take birth in Gurukula somewhere in India and then I'll learn all this stuff. I'm too old. So this is not the proper attitude to have if one wants to acquire education. One should think, I'm eternal. I'm eternal. I will not suffer from death. Because sometimes the mind is material, and the mind is often, of course, when the mind is in the conditioned state, as we know from 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, then the mind is our enemy, and so is an agent of Maya. And so the mind will say, why do you want to go to school for? And when I was growing up, they used to have this saying, kids would say, when we were going to school, some other kids would say, hey, they would laugh at us, they'd say, hey, where are you guys going? They were playing, and we would say, we're going to school. And they'd say, ah, ha, ha, we don't go to school. School is for those who don't know anything. What are you going to school for? We're going to learn. Ah, ha, ha, we already know everything, so school is for those who don't know anything. They would joke like that. That's how they rationalize playing all day. So this is how the mind works. The mind will trick us into reasoning that we cannot study, we cannot learn for this reason, for that reason. The mind will say, why are you going to spend 15, 20 years going to school? You know, and when death comes, it's all lost. You just wasted all that time. You could have spent the time like enjoying like anything. So here is the proper attitude. No, we should not consider, in chasing after education, we should think, I'm never going to die. Not only that, not only am I going to not die, but I'm never going to get old. Because we think, well, I'm too old, my memory's bad, I'm forgetful. They should not think like that. Those who want to acquire education, they should think, I'm pure spirit soul, and there's no obstacle, and apply himself. Even there's in India, there are instances of men who are 70 years old, and they began studying Sanskrit at 70, and were successful. It's just a matter of applying oneself. Or they had a saying in the West that, what, little drops of water bore holes in the stone. Just constant drops of water, one, after some time will bore a hole in the stone. So similarly, we should apply ourselves. It's never too late to learn. Whatever, and education is the most, as we'll see, as these verses come along, they'll glorify the education as the most priceless thing that can be obtained. So, in the Vedic culture, this is an interesting point. Rather, let me go back a little bit. The mind might suggest, but what about old age? We cannot enjoy when our senses become weak. So here, this verse says, ajara means free from old age. One should think he has eternal youth while acquiring education and wealth. The point is that even if our goal is to enjoy, we cannot do so without wealth, which cannot be obtained properly without education. Even if one is uneducated and by good fortune has wealth, it will not last for long, as it is known that a fool and his money are soon parted. It means if a person is foolish, it's very easy to trick him out of his money. One devotee who was not foolish, but inexperienced in India, one time paid 300 rupees to a rickshaw wala to go from here to Lloyd Bazaar.
Really?
So, yeah. So, or one time another man went outside and said, I want to go to Radhakund. And the rickshaw man said, okay, get on the back, we're just now going. And he pedaled all day to go to Radhakund by rickshaw. Because he didn't know how far it was or anything. So persons who are, they're not foolish, but they're inexperienced, then of course they're easily taken advantage of. So therefore it's explained here that even if you're not educated and somehow by good fortune you get money, you can lose it very easily because you don't have your wits. You know, you haven't been trained and you haven't been educated. So, thus the author says, vidyam artham cha, first education and then wealth. And if one's goal is beyond material enjoyment, then one certainly needs vidya. It is better to study during youth when the mind is not burdened by anxieties and the memory is strong. It is much more difficult to study later on in life, especially if one has not practiced studying while young. In the Vedic culture, the first part of life is exclusively devoted to studies. One's attention becomes diverted after marriage, and for this reason, a student remains celibate. The primary meaning of brahmachari is student, and celibacy comes as a requirement for being a student. So now, naturally, when one reads this verse, one who thinks about this verse, a doubt will arise in his mind. One may doubt, one may think, if a person thinks he will never die, it may encourage him to act sinfully, as people in general act religiously to avoid punishment after death. Right? Sometimes if I'm not going to die, then hey, I don't have to worry about being punished. Therefore, I don't have to worry about pious or impious activity. The mind may trick one to think like this. So to avoid this type of, to negate this tendency of the mind, the author writes the second half of the verse, that one should act religiously, that when he does perform religious acts, he should do so as if now I'm just about to die. So let me do this act very, very nicely. Let me go today when I go to Mangal Artik, let me think this is my last Mangal Artik in Vrindavan. And then one will have a very intense mood. And he'll say, this is after today, I'll never be able to see these beautiful deities again. I'll never be able to hear the kirtan again. This is it. Then he's very attentive. So he says one should have this attitude when he performs religious deeds, religious acts. He should not commit sin knowing very well he will suffer the result. It is seen when one witnesses death, a sense of religiosity and renunciation creeps in, although it is mostly temporary. This is called smasan vairagya. You know that term, Dadu? Smasan? Smasan means?
Crematorium.
Smasan vairagya means the crematorium. The how do you say?
Shoshan.
My Bengali accent is very poor. But this is a common type. And while the body is there burning, then everyone's thinking, next, that could happen to me, and I have all these plans, but what importance are they? They're all finished, they're all going to burn with his body, and one becomes, actually, what's the use of all my plans? I'm leaving home, I'm going to holy place. But because that type of vairagya, which is born from the crematorium, it does not last very long. While one is experiencing the sorrow and anxiety of having lost his family member, then he feels renounced. But as that anxiety, or as that sorrow fades away, so does the renunciation. It's not that the condition of one's heart has become changed, but it's just that one is temporarily affected, and one is temporarily confronted with the miseries of this human life. So, yet, if one continuously remembers that imminent death, then he can become actually renounced and religious. An interesting history illustrates this point. Once a man went to a holy place and he approached a saintly person and he asked him, I want to reveal my mind to you. I need help. So he approached. When one goes to a holy place, it's explained that if you just go there to take your bath, then you're no better than a cow or an ass. You should seek out association with saintly persons in a holy place. So this man did that. And he asked him, he said, my mind always, always hankers for sense pleasure. He's telling some saintly person, he's asking, you please tell me how I can control my mind, because it's always hankering for sense enjoyment. So the saint, then he closed his eyes. He was very grave. He looked at him straight in the eye. And he said, that's another symptom. While talking, one's eyes are going here and there and not looking in the face, then he's also indifferent. So the saint looked him straight in the face, looked in the eye, says, I'll tell you how to do this. But first there's something, you're faced with something more serious. He said, I can understand by seeing your face and your physiognomy. Physiognomy is a study of the body. By the lines on the forehead, how the ears are positioned, how the eyes, eyebrows and lips and nose are all organized. That's how when the sages reached the bank of the Ganges, when Maharaj Parikshit was preparing to leave the planet, they didn't know who was the most qualified to speak to Maharaj Parikshit. And then when Sukadeva Goswami came, it's explained there that by this knowledge of, Lakshangya, or physiognomy, they immediately understood Sukadeva Goswami was the most qualified man because of his bodily characteristics. He had long arms, like Lord Chaitanya. He was bluish in color. He was very innocent, very beautiful form. So this saint is looking at the man's face and said, the fact is, I'll tell you how to control your mind and senses, but first I have to tell you that you only have 7 days to live. You're going to die in 7 days. I can see it written on you. So the man became, oh my God. So the man said, you immediately go home. You immediately go back to your home and take care of all your business and come back in 2 days. Then I'll tell you. So the man thought, he was shocked. So he said, oh my God, now I've got to go finish my business. I've got to get my wife situated, my children. He ran home. He announced the sage's prophecy to all his family members. They were all shocked. But anyway, they said, well, we have to help you prepare. So he settled as many things as possible in those 2 days. Then he went to the temple. He distributed wealth, gave in charity. He was just thinking, well, I'm leaving this body. Now I have to try to assure that my next life will be better than this one. So he was giving in charity and giving blessings to his children and so forth. And then on the third day, he returned to that holy place and to that saintly person. And so then the saint asked him, so you took care of everything? He says, yes. And he says, well, while you were gone, over that period of time, did your mind disturb you? And the man said, no, I had no time. I had no time to think about sense gratification. I was just, going to the temple, talking over the last things with my wife and this and that. I said, I had no time for that. So then the saint says, so now, your problem is solved. Your question is answered. He said that I have answered your question about controlling your mind. Always remember that you may die at any time, and your mind will no longer trouble you for sense pleasure. And so these Actually, the saint used niti. You understand? He wanted to accomplish a certain goal, right? His goal was to not just to tell the man, but to make him experience it, right? To make him experience, to make him understand the answer himself. One thing is if you have a question and someone tells you the answer to the question, it doesn't have as much value as if you go and find out for yourself. Or if this person guides you and tells you how to understand the answer on your own. Use your own intelligence to understand this answer. Or learn, you know, not in other words, the point that the sage wants him to understand the answer clearly, but he wants him to own that answer. He wants him to realize it, not just repeat it. Oh yeah, you're not this body. Oh yeah, if you think of death, your senses won't disturb you. Anyone can repeat that. But if you've understood it, if it's vigyan, if you've realized it, then it has a very powerful meaning. And then when you tell somebody that, there will be some potency in that, in your words. So therefore the sage thought, well, I can tell this man that, well, you just have to think death is right, got you by the hair. But it wouldn't change his life. So therefore he thought, how to get him to understand this point so that it changes his heart. And so he did this. He wasn't actually going to die in 7 days. So you might think, well, he tricked him or he lied to him. But actually, he used a device for that man's benefit. To benefit that person. And this way, that man actually had a change of heart. It wasn't like this graveyard, or rather, what's called a smasan, or this crematorium renunciation, but he actually transformed himself in his heart and became more detached and more religiously inclined and able to control his mind. So we have about 5 minutes left. If there are any questions or comments, we can discuss. We only didn't cover very much verses, many verses.
So, in Christian society...
I'm sorry?
Christian society,
yeah.
They observe one confession. Causal confession, the beliefs on mind of the old repentance of past misdeeds. No other society have heard of this change. Causal confession to a priest, he does, you know it of course, he does confess his old misdeeds that relieves his mind a lot. I have done something wrong, seriously wrong, cheated someone. And then I have throughout my life repented for it, but did not confess it to anyone openly. But the father confession, in presence of the priest, if I speak it out, and then brings about some relief into the heart of the man. Haven't you heard of such thing?
I've heard something like that, yeah. I was not brought up like that. But Daduji is saying that in the Christian tradition, it's actually the Catholic tradition, that... there is a system of confession where one goes, if he's carrying around, if he's performed a sinful act, that it's a burden to him. And so the system is that you go to a priest in the church and you confess that confidentially. And that is supposed to relieve the burden and remove. I don't know if it actually is meant to remove the sin. Well, I don't know how effective it is. It is effective if that person stops sinning. Yes, Mataji.
The teaching in Catholic theology about confession is must be contrition in the person.
Contrition means?
Contrition means you've seen the ugliness of it.
I see.
Turned around. You're really just giving the burden of the man.
Well, that's interesting. So if it's done with some very sincere remorse, we know from Srimad Bhagavatam that Jad Bharat, when he is in the body of a deer, he was feeling greatly repentant that he had made his mistake, and therein is explained that this type of repentance, this sincere, deep repentance, actually has a very purifying effect. And so if it's done in the proper attitude, like Sharanagati Mataji said, then it does relieve one. However, Srila Prabhupada points out that the proof will be, if they're sincere, the proof will be that they stop their sinning. And if they don't, and if they just come and confess, and then on Sunday or Saturday, and then all week they're sin again and go back and confess, then they're considered professional. They're considered professional sinners, Prabhupada says. So it means that they're not sincerely repenting. And consequently, they're not getting purified. Their heart is not getting purified by that procedure. But even in our practice, we have this system of dadati pratidinati, revealing one's mind in confidence, or also, especially with one's spiritual master, but to speak his heart to his spiritual master, so that and to express one's weaknesses before the Vaishnavas also is a very powerful thing. And freeing oneself. Just yesterday, one godbrother was speaking to his godbrothers, saying, "You know, I'm carrying this anartha in my heart now for many years, and I want to get rid of it. So please, I want to express it to you, and I want you to do whatever is necessary to help me get this out of my heart." So that's that one of our Vaishnava practices also. That, of course, those who are intimate friends in Krishna consciousness, then this is how they help each other overcome their anarthas. Or like in Denver, you have some satsanga where the men meet. Janmasthami Prabhu in his temple, they have a satsanga for the men and satsanga for the women, where they meet and discuss very openly how the obstacles they're meeting in Krishna consciousness, they're confronted with in Krishna consciousness, and they speak very honestly. I think here we also have something like that with Mother Narayani. So this is a proper form for devotees to actually grow in Krishna consciousness by unburdening yourself. Pretense and devotional service are incompatible. If we pretend, then we're called, according to Bhagavad Gita, mithyachar. Krishna says, what can... What does he say? Pretender. What is that verse? Damodar Prabhu or Mother Narayani, do you know? He said, what can repression accomplish? Right? If one... I forget exactly. But anyway, he says, one should not be... If one is given up sense enjoyment, but his mind dwells on sense objects, and he's called a pretender. So if one pretends, he can't properly progress in spiritual life. So pretense is something that devotees will not indulge in. If they're serious about progressing in spiritual life, they will not pretend that they're something they're not. They're more advanced than they're not, or something like that. All right, anything else? Yes, Janma.
There's the one, I was trying to find in the index of the Hymns of Devotion, but I seem to remember that Prabhupada, maybe you know where, Prabhupada, into devotion says that one was very serious about spiritual advancement. He thinks that it's going to, it's his last day.
I've heard it, but I don't know where it is. Yeah, Nectar of Devotion.
Pretty sure that's where it is.
That's a very healthy attitude in spiritual life.
The older you get, the easier it is to start seeing it's then last.
So do you think, how many of you think that the information in Hitopadesh is valuable after hearing these first few classes? It seems like it's valuable? You think it's like worthwhile information? Yeah or no? All right. So we'll continue tomorrow then. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.